My biggest frustration is the fact that this society has not been willing to take some basic steps to keep guns out of the hands of, you know, people who can do just unbelievable damage. A couple of decades ago, Australia had a mass shooting. And Australia just said, well, that's it. We're not seeing that again. Yeah. And imposed very severe gun laws, and they haven't had a mass shooting since.
Every other day, somewhere in the United States, there's a mass shooting. A gunman will fire upon a group of everyday people, sometimes school children, with a semi-automatic weapon designed for a battlefield. And every time it happens, President Obama makes a point of addressing the media at the White House, and you can hear him fighting back his anger and his grief. But increasingly, I've noticed that in the US, when it's said that it's just not possible to change America's gun laws, people will say, look at Australia. They did it. So what did we do? Well, let's start with a bit of perspective. From the mid-80s to the mid-90s, there were 11 mass shootings here in Australia by deranged people who somehow got access to high-powered semi-automatic weapons.
Melbourne police have charged a 19-year-old former Duntroon cadet with the murder of one of the six people gunned down on the streets of Clifton Hill last night.
It began at exactly 9:30, according to residents whose houses line the street of murder.
And this city remains stunned by yesterday's massacre. It was a semi-automatic carbine used to slaughter eight innocent people in the Australia Post headquarters in Queen Street.
The people who live in Melbourne's inner suburbs still can't believe...
The circuit breaker was the massacre at Port Arthur, Tasmania, 20 years ago, which left 35 men, women and children dead and 22 people horribly wounded. The gunman used two semi-automatic weapons, and so the first 10 people killed at Port Arthur were killed within the space of 15 to 30 seconds. The newly elected Prime Minister at the time, John Howard, acted to get semi-automatic weapons off the streets. And in doing so, he shocked and angered some of his closest supporters. Law-abiding gun owners felt demonised. John Howard knew this would happen, but he did it anyway, believing that the change was in the broader national interest. And now, from the distance of 20 years, we can see this was a genuine defining moment in Australian history. Before the new gun laws, Australia was averaging one gun massacre a year. Since the change, well, we haven't had any. John Howard was Prime Minister of Australia from 1996 to 2007, and he still regards the reform of Australia's gun laws as one of his most important achievements as Prime Minister. Welcome back, Mr. Howard.
Good to be with you, Richard.
1995, year before you became Prime Minister, you made a headland speech as opposition leader calling for improved gun laws, well before the Port Arthur massacre. How had your thinking evolved on this issue over time to lead you to make that speech?
It seemed very much an exercise in common sense. Put it bluntly, it's easier to kill 10 people with a gun, particularly a semi-automatic weapon, than it is to kill them with an axe or a knife. And it's the ready availability of weapons, particularly high-powered ones, that underpins the likelihood of massacres. And it seemed to me, particularly observing the American scene, which I always did, and anybody must in the modern Australia, because of the enormous cultural influence of the United States through film, television, video, etc., that the ready availability of guns inevitably led to massacres. And it just seemed that at some point Australia ought to try and do something so as not to go down the American path. I knew there were political issues about tightening gun laws, but it just seemed to me logical that at some point we'd have to try and tighten our laws, and that we had to avoid going down the American path, because so many things there are done by America that we, because of America's cultural hegemony, copy unconsciously. And I worried that we might do that in relation to guns, and I didn't want that to happen.
Your father was a veteran. Did he bring any weapons home with him?
Oh, my father was a veteran of the First World War. He brought home an old German Luger pistol, and it was lay around the house, but it was rusted and broken and obviously completely incapable of being fired in anger. But I remember once when I was about 10, I was playing with him in the front yard with a couple of kids, was showing it to them, and somebody passing must have reported that to the police. So the police turned up and they wanted to have a look at it and say, you know, what is this, this dangerous weapon? They had a look at it, and there were a couple of them. They showed it to each other and they handed it back and said, this is not going to cause any damage. But it was an interesting thing. This would have been Australia in probably the late 1940s, suburban Australia in the late 1940s. And the idea that, however inoperably looking the weapon may have been, a passerby saw it, thought it was her duty to report it to the police, and the police came.
John Button used to say, he might have been quoting someone else, that Australia and the United States have about 90% in common, but the 10% that's different is really different. I wonder what you think about that, Australia and the United States, if you'd agree with that statement. And
I don't know that I'd put precisely that percentage, but it is absolutely the case that we have a lot of things in common. But where we diverge, such as the gun culture, our quite different senses of humour, the differences are quite marked, particularly if you are living in the United States.
Prime Minister-elect John Howard's moved quickly to put arrangements in place for the new coalition government. He's called coalition members to Canberra for a party meeting within days.
The election success dazzled...
I was elected on the 2nd of March and took office on the 11th of March.
With a large majority.
With a huge majority, a very large majority.
And just a bit over a month later.
Just late April, Port Arthur occurred.
How were you advised that something was going
on? I heard
on?
It first on the media, and then my press office rang me. I was at Kirribilli House. Like everybody else, I flicked on the television, started watching the coverage. It was during the day on Sunday. I kept getting updates from my office and my department. But in situations like this, the officials, like everybody else, are really relying on the police on the spot, and often the information that the police provide to the media is just as contemporary as it should be, because there's a public interest in these events as the information they provide to the government. And I was rung by the Tasmanian Premier, Tony Rundle, and he was shaken, as you'd expect. And he talked then about the possibility of tighter gun laws, which was encouraging. And like everybody else, I was absolutely horrified by what had happened. I went to Canberra that night. I remember having a meeting with people on my staff and somebody from my department who was involved in this whole operation in the area responsible, if you like, for any potential federal response, came to the lodge and we sat and talked about it for a couple of hours.
What did you discuss? The
well, we discussed what had happened. We discussed immediately the possibility of changing the law.
So even right then?
I felt then that we had to keep open the possibility of tightening the law. And then Tony Rundle asked me to come to Tasmania and to visit Port Arthur, which I did. And Kim Beazley and Cheryl Curnow, who was then the leader of the Australian Democrats, came with me, and we laid a wreath. And on the Tuesday, I attended a memorial service at the Anglican Cathedral.
What do you remember of that day, the atmosphere?
Was somber, understates it. People were in a state of shock. We couldn't believe this. This was the largest single massacre at the hands of one person ever, until the Brevik massacre in Norway several years ago of 35 people. And I recall it was probably on the Sunday afternoon, perhaps the Monday morning, I received a message from John Major, who was still the Prime Minister of Britain at the time, expressing condolences for what had happened. And he remarked in the message that Britain a few months earlier had experienced the Dunblane massacre in Scotland, where I think 27 or 28 people had died. I couldn't believe that within a few months he'd be witnessing an even greater massacre in Tasmania.
At that memorial service, Dr. Brian Walpole was there, who had worked on some of the victims, and he was quite overcome with grief. Just tell me about how you met him.
A number of people after the service. They were people who had helped in different ways, and most particularly the people who'd rendered medical help to the wounded, and he had led the surgical team, I think, so had seen the impact, and he was quite overcome.
What should a Prime Minister do in those circumstances?
Well, I did the natural thing. I embraced him. It was a normal human thing to do. I've always found, as Prime Minister, when you encountered people who were clearly in a state of shock or grief, the best thing was to do was to be natural. If you felt it was a person who would appreciate a hug or some kind of physical gesture, you did. If you felt, if you made a judgment that maybe all they wanted was a handshake and an eye connection and an expression of sympathy, you did that. It's something that you just rely on intuition, and instinct is a wonderful instructor, if I can put it that way, when it comes to immediately unexpected difficult situations. My instinct was that this was a terrible event that had really upset a lot of people, and Dr. Walpole was an example of that.
Walter Mikach as well. He lost his daughters.
Well, he showed remarkable fortitude. I saw him on a number of occasions afterwards. He established the foundation named after his two daughters, and I was involved in promoting that, and I kept in touch with him, and I saw him only a few months ago at a luncheon that was organised by the gun control movement to just keep focus on the possibility that some of the gun laws might be watered down, and Walter was there. He's remarried and has another family, but of course never will forget the terrible loss that he suffered in April of 1996.
So there's the moment when that storm of national grief and horror starts to subside, and you're discussing reform of Australia's gun laws with your staff. What did your staff say when you said you wanted to pursue this?
Well, a lot of people around me said, this is a terrible tragedy, but don't overreach. The history of trying to do things like this in Australia is, things like this is very checkered, and the states will be resistant. It will be very difficult for some of our rural colleagues, both Liberals and Nationals. It wasn't only National Party people, because for most of the time that I was Prime Minister, the Liberal Party held as many seats in rural and provincial Australia as did the National Party, on some occasions more. So it wasn't just a National Party issue. But I, from the beginning, felt that this was an occasion when something significant had to be done. It wasn't just enough to express grief and outrage and then tighten. We could easily ban the importation of automatic and semi-automatic weapons as a federal government. We had complete control over importation, but we had no control over the sale and possession of weapons except in Commonwealth territory. So that meant that the great bulk of the population was beyond the immediate legislative reach of the Commonwealth Parliament. And that meant we had to do it federally. Now, I let it be known straight away that I was considering pushing for a total ban on automatic and semi-automatic weapons, because I remember at the time had a discussion with Graham Morris, who was then my senior political advisor and who knew the politics of the coalition inside out, saying to me, boss, if you're not going to go for the doctor, if you're not going to go for a total ban, now's the time to sort of let that be known, because otherwise you'll have problems about weakening and back down, all that sort of thing. And he said, it's a very big call. And a number of the public service advisors said, look, you won't get this.
So this is the yes minister moment, when an advisor comes in and says, this would be a very courageous decision,
well,
Prime Minister.
Well, I think there were a number of people in the public service who thought that it was certainly courageous or was just not going to happen. And so I decided this was big enough and important enough to use the authority that I clearly had. I mean, at that time, I'd only been Prime Minister for 6 weeks. I had this majority of 45 in a House of 150. We'd really annihilated the Labor Party in the election, and the new leader was a very reasonable man, Kim Beazley. I knew the Labor Party would probably support any measures we brought in. And I thought, well, heaven's sake, what's the point of being in office when you can't do something significant in relation to something that affected community safety. I mean, this is something that's dear to everybody, physical safety. People talk a lot about human rights. There's no greater human right than to not lose your life in a completely random and unprovoked fashion.
So as Prime Minister, in that moment, you have advisers. You have, on the one hand, a political adviser like Graham Morris, who's got to be one voice on your shoulder, I suppose, yes, whispering,
he
saying...
He wasn't in fairness, yeah. Graham. He wasn't saying don't do it.
No,
said,
but nonetheless,
just understand.
These are the political ramifications.
Yeah, just understand how big this is.
But you have other voices from the public service saying, Prime Minister, if you do want to go ahead with this, this is how you might want to do it. So
yes.
So you're hearing a bunch of different voices,
yeah,
from
although
different directions.
What the public service people were simply saying that the only way you could have a total ban was to persuade the states to introduce mirror legislation. And at a quite early stage, it was obvious that the thing wouldn't work if we were going down that path without a gun buyback. And that gun buyback would have to be financed by the federal government.
With the government determined to get guns out of the community, we're all being asked to contribute. Owners of illegal guns will be able to hand over their weapons in return for cash, estimated to cost up to $800 million.
The federal government banned the importation
of automatic and
semi-automatic weapons, and the states were to ban the possession and sale of them. To clear the streets, so to speak, we'd have a gun buyback. There'd be an amnesty period. They'd have to hand their weapons in. They'd have them checked, verified, and then they'd get payment. That would be administered by the states, but the federal government would pay for it. I knew immediately that you couldn't expect the states. They would use that as an excuse not to do it. I felt that if we were serious, the public would support a gun buyback. And in the end, we did have a gun buyback. It was financed by a temporary levy. There was widespread public support.
And how about the purchase of guns? Because my understanding was that Martin Bryant was able to purchase a weapon from an ad in the paper, for example.
The sale and possession. Right. So there were state laws developed, and when the agreement was reached, in all material respects, they were the same. There were some local variations, but in all material respects, they were the same. Now, that was the plan.
You knew you were going to have some opposition from the states, within the state governments. But how about within your own cabinet, when you put this plan to your own cabinet? There would have been strong opposition from some members of your own government in this matter.
I think it's fair to say that from the very beginning, a number of my senior colleagues, in particularly from the National Party, such as Tim Fisher and John Anderson, pointed out to me that it was going to be very difficult, but to their eternal credit, they were prepared to go along with it.
You rang John Anderson to ask for his advice. Yes. How did that conversation go?
Well, I think I may have had a personal discussion, and you know, he rather sheepishly said, I've got a few guns, and he'd collected a few. He had quite an arsenal. But he was absolutely magnificent, and as was Tim Fisher. Sure, they both held fairly safe coalition seats, but they both knew how hard it was going to be with a lot of their farmers, because a lot of the farmers felt victimised. They thought, we have, for all our lives and our parents before us, we've had weapons, we've needed them, we've handled them carefully, we've kept them in, although the law didn't then require it, under lock and key. And why on earth should the actions of a madman impose this regime on us?
Yeah, here's a bunch of city people telling us
how to handle
our firearms.
But they wouldn't have a clue of what life is like out here in the bush. And there are a lot of people felt that way.
And you were aware of that?
I was aware of that, but I also became aware as time went by that more thoughtful people from the bush understood, despite the discomfort, understood. And I recall quite vividly going to, I think it was a rugby international between Australia and South Africa in May or early June, and the whole thing still hadn't been completely bedded down then. And quite a lot of people I ran to, they had come from the bush, and they came up to me and said, look, this is a pain in the neck for us, but you ought to stick to your guns.
So to speak, yes.
So to speak, yeah.
I'm sure they phrased it a bit more colourfully
than that.
They
were a little more blunt than that, but they said, this is a real burden for us, but we understand why you're doing it, and stick to your guns, keep going. And that was encouraging. Mind you, this was something that had widespread support in the cities.
Still, it meant antagonising your own supporters.
Oh, it did. It did.
And
mean,
this is one of the things that you normally don't ever do.
No,
in
no, no. You normally don't want to do that, and you normally shouldn't want to do it because
you're newly elected.
You're newly elected, yes. And there's enormous goodwill. Mm. People have waited 13 years to get rid of this rotten Labor government as they saw it, and we've got this new Prime Minister, and first thing he does is make life difficult for us. Now, that was the reaction of some people in rural areas, and I have no doubt that discontent about gun laws played some part in the emergence of One Nation under Pauline Hanson. It wasn't the main reason, but it was a subsidiary and quite important reason why One Nation emerged, because a lot of people who felt part of the gun culture, and I'm not talking here about farmers, I'm talking just a group of people who like firing guns for fun, many of them may well have seen themselves as part of the group of society that had been passed by economic change and felt left out and alienated. And Pauline Hanson appealed to them. And there's little doubt that in some places such as Gympie in Queensland, the One Nation movement fed off discontent about gun control. There were posters at some of her rallies about Hitler Howard having taken away the gun. So there was a connection. I'm not saying it was the main reason, but it was an element. And that made it very hard. Rob Borbidge was extremely courageous, the Queensland Premier. He was different from any of the other National Party leaders because he was the Premier of a National Party-dominated coalition government in Queensland. He'd only been in for a short period of time. And I rang him and he said, "John, this is going to be very, very difficult for me." And I said, "I understand that, Rob, but I've got to do it." And he said, "Well, I will back you, but please understand how difficult it's going to be for me." And he never wavered. He was defeated at the next election, and the strength of the One Nation vote at the 1998 Queensland state election was the principal reason why he lost. So he paid the heaviest price of all, and I've always acknowledged his courage and that of Tim Fisher and John Anderson.
Rob Borbidge might have been very supportive, but there was a police minister's meeting from the states led by your Attorney General, Darryl Williams, and the police minister, Russell Cooper, was there, as well as the police minister from Western Australia. They were quite opposed at that
stage.
They
were
very hostile.
Very reluctant. I arranged to be in Canberra when that meeting took place.
You weren't in the room, though.
I wasn't in the room at the beginning. No, I wasn't at the beginning. And I didn't want to be because I didn't want to appear that I didn't have full confidence in the Attorney General. I did have full confidence in the Attorney General.
This is just interesting about the art of government here, I think. You make a decision not to be in that room.
Well, because it was a meeting of police ministers.
Yes, indeed. But if you reach an impasse,
I just happened to be there.
You can break the impasse.
Well,
is that the idea?
And I made sure that I was there. I was obviously talking to Darryl Williams and said, "You have the meeting, see how you go. Come and see me during the tea break and let me know what's happening." And he said, "Look, you better talk to them because Russell Cooper and I think Bob Weiss was the police minister from Western Australia." And there was a bit of resistance both on gun ownership grounds but also very much federalist grounds. They didn't like the idea of being told by a federal government, even of their own political stripe, to amend their gun laws. Now, I understood all of that. I knew the Liberal Party well, and I understood the federalist culture, particularly in the states like Queensland and Western Australia. But we had this discussion, and we sort of concluded with agreement on what we wanted. That was the total ban, but there were reservations expressed, and I was told it had to be ratified by the government, that they didn't have the authority to conclude everything on the spot, which is often a device states employ in these situations to keep their options open.
Was the idea of the buyback the breakthrough here, the idea that the Commonwealth will carry the cost of taking the weapons
off the
streets?
I don't think it was the breakthrough. I think, though, it was the principal incentive at the beginning. I knew that we had to offer that.
So that was what brought them to the table.
That in a way is what it was. One of the things that legitimised the leadership role of the federal government.
So nonetheless, you wanted to hold the line on this issue. Mm. How did you then bring them round?
Of the things we did was we let it be known, and I'm not saying this altered the outcome in the end, but we let it be known that if there were sustained resistance from the states, we would have a referendum.
Broadcast, podcast, on your mobile. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
It's 20 years this year since the introduction of gun law reform in Australia. The reforms were led by the federal government of John Howard after the massacre at Port Arthur in Tasmania, where 35 people were killed by a gunman armed with two semi-automatic weapons. John Howard had flagged his interest in gun law reform well before the attack, before he was elected, and the reform proposal received broad national support, but it alienated many people on his side of politics, as well as law-abiding gun owners who felt they were being demonised by the actions of a single deranged human being. But after 20 years, gun massacres have all but disappeared in Australia, and now more and more Americans who want to change their laws are looking to the example set by Australia. John Howard, you were saying that when you were dealing with states like WA and Queensland who had reservations about the gun law reform proposals, you let it be known that you were prepared to put the question to a referendum. Did you mean it?
Yes, I would have. I'd have had a referendum if we'd have had sustained resistance, and I think the referendum would have been carried. It would have been carried overwhelmingly, in my opinion, because the anger was still sufficiently strong. So I didn't want to have a referendum.
No. So how do you put that? I mean, that can be seen as browbeating the opposition.
Yeah,
so how do you do that then?
Oh, I think that's... Governments do that. I mean, states often let it be known that they won't participate in something, and nobody ever quite says it.
So you don't actually say that across the table.
Yeah, you actually write a letter. But,
right. No, or even say it across the table.
But you let it be known. And one of the people who I think let it be known was the Deputy Prime Minister.
Tim Fisher.
Yes. He felt quite strongly that it was something that had to be done. And I had a number of discussions with Richard Court, who was then the Premier of Western Australia, and again with Rob Borbidge, and I kept saying, well, I acknowledge the difficulty of all of this, but we're quite determined to go ahead with it, and we have to go ahead with it.
I know you won't be shocked when I say this. Politics can be a cynical business at times. Were there people who just thought you weren't serious, that this was going to be about the politics of gesture, and that if they pushed hard enough back,
I think at the beginning there were people who thought that. But as time went by and as we continued to resist attempts to water it down, now one of the attempts to water it down came in our party room where a couple of members from rural areas raised what was called crimping. Now, crimping was an action whereby you disabled the magazine or some part of the automatic weapon so that it couldn't operate automatically. It had to operate like a bolt-action rifle. And they said, well, if you allow people who've got these weapons to crimp them, won't that be enough? Surely you're being unreasonable. And I said, well, I'm sceptical. I don't understand the mechanics of automatic rifles.
So where did you go for advice?
Well, I went first of all to the federal police, and the federal police thought the crimping thing would work pretty well. And I was still uncomfortable. I was sceptical, and I'm not saying the police didn't do it conscientiously. So I then said, well, give it to the army. And I remember Graham Morris ringing me up, and he said it took those army blokes no more than half an hour to reverse the crimping process. And I thought, that's enough for me. And I went back to the party room, where I think I'd probably let it be known publicly that we'd done this and we'd reached the conclusion that crimping was out. That wasn't a satisfactory alternative. Now, that was an illustration that the issue was still, until the laws finally passed this and the buyback began to be implemented, it was still a live issue. I remember discussing the levy with Peter Costello, the treasurer, and he was very supportive of what we were doing, and he was very supportive of the levy because it meant that the budget bottom line wasn't hit, and it was cleanly done. We said it will be a levy of this amount of money. It will be for this particular purpose.
Yeah, it's attached to the Medicare levy, as I recall.
Yeah.
That way you could kind of see what it was on your tax return.
It was done very transparently, and Peter was able to say in his budget, we're bringing it in for this purpose, you know why, and after a year we will have raised the money and then we'll take it off, and we did.
Now, you were approached by other people in the coalition. Bill McGrath, the National Party leader in Victoria, came and saw you and said, look, I've got a property. During a drought, I needed a semi-automatic weapon to put down a lot of my stock. And if you don't have a semi-automatic weapon, it can be this awful, drawn-out process. I know. What did you think when you heard that?
Well, that was an exemplar of the outrage felt by legitimate, honest, decent, law-abiding farmers who kept saying, well, you know, why should we be penalised because of the criminal madness of somebody else? Now, I sympathise with them.
So what can you say to him then? I'm sorry.
All you can ever say is, I'm sorry, but if we make that exception, somebody else will be on my back for another exemption. And I just knew from experience in government that once you allow special cases, the whole landscape is littered with special cases, because there's always another special case. There's no such thing as a unique claim on an exception to a general rule.
The National Buyback Scheme saw 659,940 firearms destroyed. I've seen some footage, funnily enough, from the US National Rifle Association's website of great big sort of garbage manglers picking up guns and smashing them up.
They've got it.
It's very, very powerful.
I thought it was terrific footage. But I'd have a different view.
Your tax dollars at work, wasn't it?
Something like that.
Part of the scheme was that you offered an amnesty for people who had these weapons without a license. No buyback for that, but just handed in, no questions asked. Did that work? Did people hand in stuff?
Yeah, it did. A lot of people handed in weapons, yes. I'm sure not everybody did, but there were a lot of weapons handed in, but no questions asked. I think that 600 and that figure you quoted, I did a calculation that it's the equivalent of about 40 million guns in America.
You went to Sale in Gippsland to make a speech.
Ladies and gentlemen, Prime Minister of Australia, John Howard.
Thank you very much. What we've seen, ladies and gentlemen, is that we believe that it is in the national interest.
Why did you want to do that in person, be there in person to make that speech?
I felt that this was one of those things where the person responsible shouldn't be afraid to face the people who are angry. Australians deep down are reasonable, law-abiding people. Not all of them, most of them are.
No, not all of them are. I mean, no. I'm not putting any aspersions on those people either.
No.
Nonetheless, you did receive a warning.
Well, a guy received a warning and it led to me making a mistake, which has embarrassed me ever since. My office, Graham Morris, who was travelling with me, said the Federal Police Protection Unit I had been warned by the local police that somebody had rung them or gone to the office and said, we're going to shoot the bastard. It was a death threat. And they said he ought to wear he oughtn't to do it, but if he's insistent on doing it, he should wear a bulletproof vest. And I first of all said, no, I'm not going to wear a bulletproof vest. And then Graham said, look, you've only been Prime Minister a few weeks. What am I going to say to Jeanette and the children if something happens? And in the end, I agreed. When I saw the footage afterwards, you could see the vest through my sports jacket, and I felt embarrassed. I've never worn a vest. I never wore one since. And later on, after I'd made the speech, I did go down and talk to some of the people in the crowd. I didn't feel unsafe. It was just an error of judgment on my part. I don't blame Graham. I don't blame the police. They just did their job.
You never felt unsafe at any point?
No, I didn't feel unsafe.
Genuinely, you never felt unsafe?
No, I never felt
unsafe. Very angry people there.
Yeah, there were some angry people there, but I'd been to a lot of rallies in the past where I'd seen a lot of anger. I think some of the anger there was probably a bit more genuine than some of the rallies I'd been to in the 60s on foreign policy issues where I think people were engaging in a bit of rope demonstrating. But It was an error of judgment. I felt embarrassed thereafter. But
did the speech do any good? Can you were they even prepared to even listen to what you had to say?
Oh, I don't think so. But people who feel so motivated to go to something like that probably aren't. But I do think the fact that I was prepared to argue the case in seemingly difficult, hostile environments always helped. It always does to be seen as willing to confront your most energetic and vociferous critics.
Get a bit outraged by pictures of you making you out to look like Hitler?
Outrage is probably too strong an expression. I accept all of that. Political leaders have to accept that. I often, years later, are amused at some of the sensitivity displayed by some of my predecessors about criticism made of them. You've got to cop a certain amount. And if you're not prepared to cop it, well, the old adage of Harry Truman applies. You can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen.
There was a suggestion at the time that some sporting shooters and other shooters were nonetheless infiltrating the Liberal parties and national parties at the time, taking out membership en masse so that they could raise their objections to your gun laws through party forums. Were you aware of that at the time?
I heard the suggestions and no doubt it happened in a very low-level manner, but it didn't manifest itself. It was after months had gone by, the issue settled down. I knew it would continue to simmer and have an impact via the growth of One Nation.
You remember the slogan of the Australian Democrats, such as they were back then, was "Keep the bastards honest." Pauline Hanson rejected that idea. She said her slogan would be "Get rid of the bastards." Do you think that speaks to a kind of nihilism that might have been there? You've been making reference there to people who'd been washed up in the problems of economic change and feeling left behind, that there was some very deep-seated anger there amongst parts of the community who hadn't done well out of economic change.
I think a nihilistic mood that she caught there with that? No, I think there was an element of that. Our politics now is more fragmented than it used to be. You don't have the solid, immovable blocks of constant support for the two sides of politics. I grew up in what I call a 40-40-20 environment. 40% always voted Liberal, 40% always voted Labor, and 20% moved around. It's now closer to 30-30-40, where and a lot of left-wing people will go off to the Greens from time to time. People on the centre-right of politics will go off to, say, Pauline Hanson, or because she attracted most of her support from people who probably voted for the coalition at the 1996 election. All the surveys suggest that. Not all of them. She got some renegade Labor people as well. So there were people who supported her who were in the legion of the deprived, the dispossessed or missed out, and there were other people who genuinely believed in going back to an era of high tariff protection and more government involvement in industry. And
do you think there's a lesson for you there as Prime Minister about trying to bring those people back into the
broader culture? Oh, there was certainly. I mean, my approach to One Nation was not to brand all of her supporters as racist. I thought that was inaccurate, oversimplistic. In the end, her ignorance on economic matters was a major reason for her undoing when she started to promote a very weirdo tax system and essentially railed against foreign investment and advocated a very interventionist approach, and people started to realise that she had no answers to the nation's problems. In the end, a political party can't survive simply on attacking others. A political party has got to have some solution, some program for the future, and after a while people got tired of her. But in the meantime, it did quite a lot of damage to us, and one of the original drivers were our gun laws.
It was all done very quick smart, actually. 4 months from what I can tell, devised, debated, implemented. Was keeping that momentum going part of your strategy?
Keeping the momentum was absolutely critical, because when you've got the federal government and you've got 8 state and territory governments, it's easy for slippage, particularly when 2 of the governments, although they went along with it to their great credit, they had deep-seated internal reluctance, if I can put it that way. So we had to keep pushing. I did get good support, I should acknowledge, from the Labor opposition under Kim Beazley and also the New South Wales government, which was the one Labor administration. Bob Carr was the Premier. He was very supportive. I give him credit for that.
Who were your allies? I've talked a lot about conflict here, but really there was a lot of support from community groups.
Well,
too,
my allies were the great bulk of people. Very, very strong support from women. And strong support from quarters that I don't normally get to. But I think it was probably the only time in my political career where I might have polled a majority in Annandale. Very pro-Labor in a suburb of Sydney, for the benefit of those who don't know.
What were people saying to you in the street?
Well,
you went on your morning walks.
A woman coming up to me once in the street and saying, "Listen, John, I've never voted for you in my life and I never will, but you're absolutely right about the gun laws."
People can do that to a prime minister in Australia,
can
they?
You can. It's one of the endearing things about our democracy. I thanked her.
That's what we damn well need in this country and in Queensland, is that some people stand up and stand up for what you believe and be out there fighting for the people.
I may not be overly excited at the result, but I accept the will and the verdict and the judgment of the people.
1998, the state election in Queensland. Rob Borbidge, the Premier there, leader of a coalition government, he lost government. Only just. I think there were 11 One Nation members elected to Parliament at the expense of the National Party, maybe the Liberal Party as well, I'm not sure. Probably
largely National.
Largely the National Party. What did you think when you were watching those results come in?
Well, I was unhappy, concerned. I felt sorry for Borbidge, very sorry. He'd paid a very heavy price, but it wasn't the
only... Did he resent you for that?
No, we have remained good friends, because I think he realised that there were other reasons too why he lost. But the gun laws had not helped, and the rise of One Nation, which, let me stress, was not overwhelmingly due to the guns. I think the gun issue played a part, but absent the guns, they still would have been a problem. But the gun issue gave fodder for the One Nation campaign.
It's 20 years on now since those laws have been introduced. How do you measure the success or lack of success of the gun laws that you introduced?
Well, I measure them by the irrefutable surveys and evidence, the absence of the massacres we had before they were introduced, the sharp fall in the suicide rate, particularly in rural areas amongst young people. The male suicide rate for young people in Australia in the mid-1990s was one of the highest in the world. Now, it's come down. The gun laws, once again, are not the only reason, but one of the reasons. And the feeling that people have, that it is a safer country than it would otherwise have been. And this has come back into people's consciousness, not only because of recurring massacres in the United States, but because of the terrorist massacres in Europe. One of the differences between Australia and Europe is that there are large volumes of automatic and semi-automatic weapons swirling around Europe as a result of the Balkan Wars. It really brings me back to the central point about gun laws. It's the ready availability of lethal weapons and the inevitable consequences when people lose their temper. We'll get into an argument that if there's a weapon available, it's far easier to use that with lethal effect than it is a knife or a hammer.
You've been out of office for some years now. Your profile in the United States has probably never been higher than it is right now. I don't think I ever was expecting to see either you or Rob Borbidge on Jon Stewart's Daily Show on Comedy Central, but there you were being shown as an example of what happens when you do pass gun laws and you have leaders like Borbidge who are prepared to wear the consequences, even if it means losing office, because it's a kind of a common thing that's said in the United States, oh, well, no one would be so crazy to try and want to introduce this. It would cost them their career. Well, it is done. It does happen, and Australia is pointed to as an example. Are you finding now that you are being invited to talk on the US media about this more and more?
Oh, yes. Every time there's something virtually. There was the massacre of 14 people in San Bernardo, just 100 kilometres east of Los Angeles. I was asked by CNN the following day to do an interview. I have done a lot of interviews. I didn't agree to that particular one because I don't want to overdo it. And the last thing I want to do is to pretend that the culture and the circumstances in Australia and America are the same. And gun possession is seen as wrongly, in my view, and historically erroneous, in my view, as being some kind of fundamental right for the individual, who's really the right to, was the intent. The original intention was a right to maintain state militias, and that's quite different. And there was still this feeling growing out of the American Revolution that the naughty central government or some force would come and take away our rights. Now,
doesn't Thomas Jefferson say sometimes the tree of liberty must be watered with the blood of martyrs?
No one
would ever say that
No, I mean, the British gave us our independence. We voted for it. We voted for our constitution. The very democratic origins of Australia is not as well known amongst the Australian population as it should be. We arrived at our constitution even more democratically than the Americans did.
You remained friends with former US President George H.W. Bush, the first George Bush, the first President Bush the Elder, if you like. And you were invited to his place in Texas to make a speech. How did your speech go over?
Well, that was an example of always needing to know your audience. I was invited. It was a lovely occasion. He invited me to his presidential library in College Station in Texas, and it was a nice event, and he had several hundred friends and supporters, and they were all very politically sympathetic to me because we're broadly on the same side of politics. And I gave a little speech, and then they applauded that, and then they asked me some questions, and one fellow got up and said, "What are the things you're proud of?" And I said, we stood beside the United States in the fight against terrorism, loud applause. Got our budget balanced, very loud applause. And we brought in national gun control laws. And the audience went, "Ooh." And
I realized, they made that noise today.
It was like a balloon, you know, the sound of air exhaling from a balloon. And he said to me afterwards, "John, you pulled the wrong rein on that." Just a different culture.
Senator David Leyenhelm is the leading voice in the parliament at the moment, calling for your gun laws to be relaxed. He told the US's National Rifle Association in an interview that Australia is, as a result of your gun laws, a nation of victims now, that we are defenceless. What do you say to that?
Well, that's absurd, and I think it's a very small minority that he speaks for. David Leyenhelm's an interesting figure. On economic issues, I largely agree with him. He's what you might call a libertarian. He's a strong believer in free markets. But when it comes to social issues, unlike me, is not a social conservative. He doesn't see any kind of capacity for the government to express a community standard or a community attitude when it should be. And I regard gun control laws as dare I say it, a human rights issue. I said earlier that the right not to lose your life in a random, arbitrary, brutal, unprovoked fashion is about as basic a human right as you can possibly have. And I think government have an obligation to support that particular human right. I always have. And one way you do it is to deprive the community of the ready availability of guns. I think the argument that you need a gun to protect yourself against a madman, which is used by the National Rifle Association in the United States, is a fallacious argument because it's the ready availability of weapons in the first instance that brings forth the need to using that tortured argument to have a weapon to defend yourself. And I think our experience has demonstrated just how effective reducing the number of weapons can be, acknowledging always in the interest of objectivity that the starting point of Australia and the starting point of America has been very different.
What lessons are there about prime ministerial leadership here? I mean, in the 11 years of your government, you tried things that worked, some things flew, some things didn't fly, some things, you know, crashed.
Some things were popular, some things were unpopular.
That's right. What lessons are there? If you know, there aren't many people in the ex-Prime Minister's Club in Australia, although that's growing all the time, I would say. Nonetheless, what lessons are there to be given to Prime Ministers about instituting a reform like this and process and the like?
The most important lesson is that big mandates always disappear, always. But if you have a big mandate, you've got to use it and use it to its full extent when the occasion arises. And my instinct at the time was I've just been elected with a huge mandate. There's a lot of general goodwill in the community. If I'm not prepared to chance my arm on this issue politically, then I've really failed to match the quality of the mandate I was given. There was such bewilderment. And here was remote, desolate Port Arthur. It had been a penal colony in the smallest state of Australia. And we'd seen the greatest single massacre at the hands of a single individual. Now, if that's not a case for trying to do something out of the ordinary, what is? And I think the fact that we were prepared to take such a strong stand on gun control and it turned out overall, though difficult, to be successful, that probably emboldened us to take on some other issues which probably didn't enjoy quite the same level of general support but were important in a long term. It set the tone in a way for the government. But history's full of governments having big wins and big mandates, but unless you do something with them, you won't achieve much, because I can guarantee you this, if you get a big mandate and you sit on it, it won't be there next time.
Mr. Howard, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.